We would note that this is Walters versus 8th Judicial District Court, State of Nevada, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is receivers for Community Bank of Nevada. This is case 55912. We note that Justice Perry-Gary has joined us, Justice Pickering has recused herself, and Justice Hardesty will participate after reviewing the tapes in this matter. If counsel would state their name for the record and if they wish to reserve any time.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm Dennis Kennedy representing William Walters, the petitioner. Factual background of this is pretty simple and straightforward. It arises out of the sale of a golf course in 2006. The sale was from a Walters entity to 26, call them investors. In round numbers, the purchase price was $24 million, $9 million in cash from the 26 investors, and a $15 million loan. The loan was to the 26 investors, each having a part of it, by Community Bank of Nevada.
Mr. Kennedy, who is the maker of the note to Community Bank of Nevada?
The notes are made by each of the individual, we call them TICs, tenant in common entities. So there are 26 of them. But the total is $15,250,000. Mr. Walters personally guaranteed the $15,250,000 loan to the TIC investors. In 2008, in the summer, there was a default, and Community Bank put the loan into default. And at that point, here's what Community Bank did, seeking to maximize its recovery. And I might add, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. They noticed the foreclosure and held the foreclosure sale of the property. That was December of 2008. They got the property back. They sued on the note, and they sued the individual 26 TIC investors on the note and for a deficiency. They sued Mr. Walters on the guarantee. So what they did was they took the property, they sued the borrowers, and they sued Mr. Walters on the guarantee. So at that point, when you look at it, your antenna automatically goes up and says, well, there's the possibility here that somebody might get the property and actually try to manipulate things so that they get more than the amount of the debt. And, of course, in Nevada, we have a 25-year history of the legislature and this court dealing with that situation. The first time that this court dealt with it was in the Shields case, First Interstate Bank versus Shields, in 1986.
Mr. Kennedy, excuse me, what was the date the trustee's sale was held, and what was the date the suits were filed against the 26 investors?
The trustee's sale was December 9th, 2008. Okay. The litigation, I'll tell you that there was some litigation started, so what the bank did, the bank's litigation was counterclaim. Those counterclaims, the first one was September 15th of 2008. The second one was December 15th of 2008, the first amended counterclaims. That was after the trustee's sale. And then April 13th of 2009, more than 4 months after the trustee's sale, was the second amended counterclaims where the bank was pursuing all these claims. So the claims were filed before the trustee's sale. First Amendment was right after the trustee's sale. Second Amendment was 4 months after the trustee's sale. These were the pleadings where the bank filed cross claims against the TIC investors and claims against Mr. Walters on the guarantee.
In those claims, was a deficiency couldn't have been sought before the trustee's sale was held, I assume.
Right.
So when did they first make a claim for a deficiency under NRS 40.455?
The claim for the deficiency is definitively made April the 13th, 2009, in the third amended counterclaim. It is a deficiency. It's denominated deficiency. And the statute is cited in there, the deficiency statute. Contrast that, Your Honor, to the claims made against Mr. Walters. There were never deficiency claims made against Mr. Walters. Those claims were made on the guarantee each time that the bank made a claim against Mr. Walters. The first counterclaim, guaranteed. First amended counterclaim, guaranteed. Second amended counterclaim made in April of 2009, 4 months after the sale, again, a counterclaim made on the guarantee. Now, we have a real definitive set of case law and statutes in Nevada that deal with this, and they're real simple. It says if that a guarantor may waive the one action rule to allow the lender to proceed directly against the guarantor. If you want to file a suit against a guarantor, ask them to waive the one action rule in the guarantee, and you can do that. But the statutes say, and we start with Shields, and then in 89, the Nevada legislature enacted a statute where it essentially memorialized the Shields holding. And it says, however, if you file an action against a guarantor, guarantor can waive the one action rule. You can proceed directly against the guarantor. You don't have to worry about anything. But if you, the lender, foreclose on the property, then if you foreclose, the guarantor has the protection of the deficiency rules, or sometimes they're called anti-deficiency rules, but same thing. And it says, and that statute says, if you do that, if you sue the guarantor and you foreclose on the property, you have to commence an action against the guarantor for a deficiency within 6 months of the sale. Now, in this case, everything happened except the deficiency proceeding against Mr. Walters. They proceeded on a direct action on the guarantee. They foreclosed in December 9th of 2008. So by June the 9th of 2009, they were required to commence a deficiency proceeding against Mr. Walters. They didn't do that. Flatly didn't do it. In fact, what they did was they filed a motion for summary judgment on the guarantee. It said this is a motion for summary judgment on the guarantee. No deficiency claim ever made. We moved for summary judgment. We went back. We had the Shields case where this court said, at that time, it was 1986. You didn't have 6 months, you had 3 months. The court said, look, it's a hard and fast three-month limitation period. You didn't file a deficiency claim against the guarantor. You had 3 months. You missed it by 3 months. You've lost that claim.
The Shields was legislatively overruled.
What happened in the legislation was the banking industry tried to get it overruled, and what happened was it ended up being codified. There's a rich legislative history where the banking industry came in, and we've provided this to the court and said, my goodness, this is going to really hurt people trying to get credit. And the legislature said, you know what, we'll allow you to proceed directly on guarantees, but we don't want you to proceed on the guarantee and take the property. And the principal lobbyist for the banking industry finally, when Assembly Judiciary Chairman Sater said, look, the Senate's standing firm and we agree with this. If you take the property as well as sue on the guarantee, you've got to give the guarantors the protection of the deficiency statute. And the banking industry said, okay, we'll accept that. So what started out as an effort to overrule Shields, and it's pretty clear from the minutes that was the intent, ended up with Shields being memorialized in the amendments to the statute.
So your position is you have to assert in a complaint or counterclaim within 6 months of the date of the trustee's sale that there is a deficiency due against the guarantor. And if they do a motion doesn't qualify as an application under 40.455.
Well, here's the thing. We didn't have a motion for a deficiency in this case. Okay? So that might work. But in this case, we didn't have a motion for a deficiency. We had a motion for summary judgment on a guarantee. And then they said, and of course, we did a credit bid for $5 million, so you're entitled to that. Our response to that was, going back to Shields, wait a minute. The Nevada Supreme Court already said, that's footnote one in Shields, the Nevada Supreme Court said, we don't accept credit bids as demonstrating fair market value, because anybody can do a credit bid for any amount, and that's not fair market value. In fact, in this case, we asked during discovery, where did that $5 million come from? Where did that credit bid come from? Is that fair market value? You know what happened? The bank asserted attorney-client privilege and said, we're not going to answer that question. That's privileged.
Well, wasn't that something Judge Denton was going to come back in and determine?
He was. Later. He said, yeah, Judge Denton, Your Honor, said, look, the motion for summary judgment is the same thing as an application for a deficiency. That's what he said. The point is, it's not. Okay? It's not. A suit on a guarantee tries to recover the entirety of the debt. There is a distinction in the statutes, a real clear distinction in the statutes, between an action on a guarantee and a deficiency action. In fact, a deficiency is defined, and it's a function of fair market value determined at the time of the sale. The statutes are really clear. There is a distinction there. And the pleadings and the claims in this matter made by the bank are just as clear. They sought deficiencies against the borrowers. They said it, the counterclaims, all the way through after the sale. Deficiency, deficiency, deficiency. And they cite the statute, the deficiency statute. What did they do against Mr. Walters? Never sought a deficiency, so they knew the difference.
Now, did the bank file a third-party complaint in this action as well, Rule 14, a third-party complaint? Or did I misread that?
No, I think what they had were they had cross claims.
So Rule 13 pleadings, not Rule 14.
Okay. Right. And so the bank knew the difference. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. But you know what that tells us? It takes us back to Shields, and it takes us back to the 89 session where Assembly Bill 557 came up. And that is... And Shields says it best, the lender can't try to manipulate through various claims and various payors its recovery to try to get the maximum recovery available. And when you look at this, that is exactly what this lender did. Different claims, different parties, allowing for different recoveries, and took the property.
Mr. Kennedy, before you sit down, though, if you'll walk me back through... have some difficulty with how NRS 40455 is set out, because it's kind of silent as to how the procedure, the application should be made. We have NRCP 7B sub 1 that talks about an application, and they're making a representation that they've complied with 40.455 by one. They made an application to the court, and the application was made within 6 months of the foreclosure, simply put. How do you respond?
That's what they say. They say, we applied for a deficiency judgment. Okay? Let's look at what they did. They made a motion for summary judgment on a guarantee, Your Honor.
But they also offered the credit, the offset.
Right. And
so why essentially isn't that net a deficiency?
It doesn't get you there for this reason, because the offset is a credit bid. It can be anything. You can bid anything as a credit bid. So if you look at the definition of deficiency, which is in the statute, the deficiency is the difference between fair market value at the time of the sale and the debt, or what it actually sold for at the sale, whichever is less. This court looked at exactly the same issue in the Shields case, where the argument was made, well, we made a credit bid. Footnote one of the Shields case, I think, the bank says, hey, we made a credit bid of $70,000. That ought to be enough. And this court said, no, it's not.
Right. That's not my point, though. I'm saying the characterization of this as a deficiency or not, going back to, you know, Judge Denton, as I indicated, was going to go back and make that determination. But I'm looking at the characterization of this.
Right. And here is what the bank did. They knew what a deficiency was because they sought the deficiency from the borrowers. They didn't seek a deficiency from Mr. Walters. They said, we will sue you on the guarantee and try to recover the entirety of the guarantee, less what we put in at the credit bid. So they knew the difference between the two. The answer to the question is, did they seek a deficiency against Mr. Walters? The answer is no, they didn't, because they knew the difference between the two. They elected not to do it. Why didn't they do it? Easy. Because you might recover more money on the guarantee less the offset than you would on the deficiency. So what they did was they made these two separate claims and did exactly what this court said should not be allowed in Shields. That was to try to manipulate the two payors to try to maximize your recovery.
But Mr. Kennedy has that argument. We don't quite get there at some points because the court didn't have an opportunity to rule on that issue yet.
They didn't. The reason that we're here on the writ petition was that we think under Shields, Jameson, and the statute, it is very, very clear. There's a rule of law that says if you don't do this within 6 months, then the claim against the guarantor should be dismissed. Now, the court hasn't had a chance to rule on what the actual value is yet, but under those two cases and the statute, it wasn't done in 6 months. And the court's clearly said in both Jameson and in Shields, you lose the claim against the guarantor if you don't do it within 6 months. So that's why we're here on the writ petition, because the rule of law is extremely clear.
Mr. Kennedy, I have one more question, if I could, for
Chief's
permission. I read the guarantee, and Mr. Walters individually signed the guarantee. Did he individually sign the note as well, or what, through an entity, or what? How was that done?
He just guaranteed it. He didn't.
He was not a maker of the note in any way, shape,
absolutely,
or form.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Just the guarantor.
Thank you.
Mr. Kennedy, we've chewed up your time. We're going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honors. Jeff Sylvester and Andy Gordon on behalf of the FDIC as receiver for Community Bank. The FDIC and the bank obviously disagree with Mr. Walters' position that we had to comply with NRS 40.4551. But assuming for now that that's true and we did have to comply, the bank still wins. Judge Denton made findings of fact. The bank satisfied the letter and spirit of 40.4551. that it followed and satisfied the spirit of the one action rule and its exemptions in its entirety, and that it satisfied this court's stated policy from the McDonald case about how one action rules, cases, and their exemptions work. Those findings of fact were not abuses of discretion, and that is the standard here.
That's an issue of law, though, isn't it?
No, it's not. Whether they complied is a factual question, and I will get to
that. Well, if you have to file within 6 months, that's an issue of law. That's a de novo.
But what it looks like and how you satisfy the policies is a factual question, we posit, and that was not an abuse of discretion. The policy that Judge Denton was looking at was the policy that this court identified in the McDonald case, a case that Justice Douglas and Perrieri signed along with Justice Rose, that says this, quote, the one action rule and its exemptions are intended to protect debtors by preventing creditors from realizing more than the face value of a debt, not to deny a creditor recovery of a legal debt altogether. To hold otherwise in this case would circumvent the purpose of a guarantee contract, which is to make the guarantor obligated in the event that the principal debtor is unable to meet the underlying obligation and the collateral proves insufficient to satisfy that debt, close quote. Mr. Walters agrees with those policies and litters his brief with them. He identifies there has to be a repose period. There has to be notice that we're seeking a guarantee claim against him and that there can't be any double recovery. He also identifies that the one action rule and its exemptions can't be a trap for the unwary. Judge Denton made findings of fact on each policy underlying the one action rule and its exemptions and NRS 40.455, which doesn't say how an application is made. We're looking more at the policies. We're looking more at how do we put him on notice that what we're doing is we're seeking to collect on his guarantee.
So, Mr. Sylvester, your argument is that Mr. Kennedy is arguing form over substance. You got there anyhow.
Absolutely. We got there, and we definitively got there. And I find it hard for Mr. Kennedy to argue that they didn't know what we were doing. We filed a motion for – we had an initial complaint on file, a counterclaim against Mr. Walters for breach of guarantee. At that time, we couldn't seek a deficiency against him because we didn't think we needed to because he had waived the one action rule, but there had been no foreclosure. After the foreclosure, we sought summary judgment. And what did our summary judgment motion say? And our amended counterclaim against Walters said the same thing. Mr. Walters signed a guarantee. He waived the one action rule. He breached his guarantee. And what we want from him is the value of the loan minus the value of the collateral. Clearly identifying and setting forth, as Justice Perry-Gary noted, the policies behind the one action rule of deficiency cases were clearly satisfied by what we filed. What we filed satisfied the definition of an application through the summary judgment motion. The amended complaint would be an application. This is a notice pleading state.
What day was the amended complaint?
Amended complaint was April of 2009.
So you're saying that's within the 6 months?
It was within the 6 month period. Judge Denton found clearly that they were both in the 6 month period. Mr. Walters doesn't argue otherwise. He argues that we didn't use the magic words. We didn't say we want a quote unquote deficiency judgment. He knows what we were looking for was the functional equivalent, the value of the property minus the value of the collateral. Judge Denton was going to have a hearing. We put forth what we believed was the value of the collateral. And for Mr. Kennedy to argue that that was somehow a manipulation is a gross misstatement of the record. When Mr. Walters was asked directly, Mr. Walters, who owned this golf course, who ran this golf course, who was probably in the best position to understand what it was worth, 1 month after the foreclosure, when asked in deposition, what is the value of this property, his answer was $2 to $3 million. We bid $5 million. For Mr. Walters to argue now that we were trying to manipulate or trying to somehow manufacture a lowball bid is a gross misstatement of the record. Judge Denton found that. Judge Denton understood what we were doing and said, you know what, we're going to have a hearing. Let's have a trial. Everybody bring in their information. I want to know what the value of the loan is. I want to know what the value of the collateral is. In that way, Judge Denton was trying to implement the policies of the McDonald case, which said, look, have a hearing. Lenders can pursue guarantors, but don't double recover. That's what was happening in this case. Mr. Walters was about to get everything he wanted from Judge Denton in terms of no double recovery. Judge Denton's findings of fact weren't an abuse of discretion, and the case ends there. We satisfied 40.455.1. But apparently, if this court wants to go further and talk about how the one action rule and its amendments were done after she, apparently we do, since we're having an en banc hearing, the bank still wins. Let's look here at what Mr. Walters admitted. He signs a guarantee, and he signs it to induce the bank to loan $15 million. In that guarantee, he waives the one action rule, he gets $15 million, he breaches the guarantee admittedly, and then puts in his pleadings, you're absolutely right, FDIC, you are allowed to sue me under NRS 40.4952 in a separate action for a guarantee, separate and apart from the one action rule, separate and apart from any obligation to enforce the debt, any foreclosure, any action against the lenders. That's in 40.4952. It says you can have these actions separate and apart from any other action on the debt. They don't even deny that we were allowed to do it. We were allowed to sue the lenders, the guarantors, everybody. Despite these admissions, Mr. Walters asks you today to find that the bank no longer has a legal right to even pursue the debt. That's directly in contravention to McDonald, which says it's not to deny the creditor the opportunity. I ask you, what did the bank do wrong? At what point did the bank violate the policy, the spirit, or the letter of the statute? At every turn, Judge Denton found the same thing. We put him on notice. We told him we wanted him to repay his debt. We told him he breached the guarantee. We told him he waived the one action rule. And we told them we wanted the value of the collateral, the value of the debt minus the value of the collateral. Everything encompassing the policy of the one action rule is satisfied. Juxtapose that to what Mr. Walters wants. He wants you to ignore McDonald. He wants you to ignore your rules of statutory construction. He wants you to ignore the very reason that NRS 40.430 was amended in the first place, which was to allow waivers. He wants you to sanction a forfeiture. And what he wants to say is, please, I want this waiver very badly at the beginning of the case. At the beginning of this loan, I need this waiver so I can get my loan. But when the time comes and it's time for me to repay, I want you to torture this statute out of existence. I want you to accept gross misstatements of the record, and I want you to make it so that the waiver that the statute offers somehow vanishes. That this now becomes a trap for the unwary bank, and now the bank isn't even allowed to collect on a $15 million obligation that Mr. Walters admits he owes. That violates every policy behind the one action rule. It sanctions forfeitures. It sanctions an injustice. The district court got this case right. When Walters waived the one action rule, this case was going to proceed under 40.4952 in a guarantee action separate and apart from the one action rule. And what was going to happen is those policies from the one action rule were going to be drawn into the separate case. Those policies from McDonald were going to be drawn in.
What's the statute of limitations on 40.495?
6 years, written obligation. We brought it within 6 months, though, so it wouldn't have mattered. Those policies from McDonald were going to be drawn in. What are those policies? Mr. Walters is going to get all the protection he wants. The bank is not going to collect more than the face value of the note. I find it hard to believe, I don't even understand how Mr. Kennedy can argue today that we were trying to double recover or maximize recovery. At every point, he even admits in his papers, we were always seeking the value of the loan minus the value of the collateral. There was never a time when we were trying to keep the property and keep the full $17 million that Mr. Walters owes. It's a $17 million obligation now, but we're giving him credit. So that's why the numbers in our complaint look like $12 or $13 million. Those policies, the general policies from litigation, in no guarantee case do you get to double recover. Doesn't matter what kind of guarantee you have, a foreclosure, a property, delivery of goods. You only get what you're out of pocket. If you've kept collateral, you have to give credit for it. Judge Denton was going to do that. That's what the whole trial was about. This case should be remanded so he can do that. Let Mr. Walters have his protection that we won't double recover, but let the bank have its protection. At the beginning of this case, the bank was induced by this waiver of the one action rule, knowing that they would then be able to go after Mr. Walters just like they could go after the borrowers or anybody else. The bank needs that protection now to make sure that Mr. Walters pays his obligations. If you look at how Shields and the one action rule were interpreted and modified, you can see easily why Walters' interpretation of 40.4953 is wrong. Shields identifies that guarantors get the protection of the one action rule. Legislature modified the one action rule to state specifically, guarantors can waive. Sophisticated guarantors like Mr. Walters, who signed guarantees of over $500,000, can waive so that they can induce the bank to. 40.430 states it directly. If the lender, if the guarantor waives, actions on the guarantee do not proceed under 40.430 to 459. That necessarily includes 40.4551. When there's a waiver, you don't seek deficiency judgments. You operate under 40.4952. You have a separate action. It's independent. It's apart from the one action rule. It's apart from actions to foreclose on the debt, to go after the guarantors, or anything. The statute clearly identifies that we can do both. We can foreclose, and we can go after the guarantee, as long as we give the proper credit. What Mr. Walters wants you to say is that under 4953, which really is nothing more than a codification of Shields, guarantors get the protection of the one action rule on one condition: they haven't waived. If they don't waive, yes, they get the protection. If they do waive, they don't. What Mr. Walters wants you to say is the bank can take advantage of the entire statutory scheme, get its waiver, operate, and do exactly what 495.2 tells them they can do. But the second they do that and they foreclose, boom, the waiver disappears.
But aren't you suggesting, Mr. Silvestri, that there would never be a situation where under 40.455 you would have to file the deficiency action?
Against borrowers, not against a guarantor who has waived the one action rule. That's the whole purpose of the waiver. is that you're not seeking deficiency judgments. You're seeking guarantee actions with all the provisions and protections that you get in a breach of guarantee. He raised a lot of defenses. The guarantee wasn't valid. He didn't owe under the money. He should have had summary judgment. We defrauded him. He raised a litany of defenses.
Mr. Savelle, let me follow up on Justice Sata's question, because I have a concern about that. I don't know if it comes into play in this case based on the facts, but if you have a six-month obligation to sue for a deficiency against the maker of the note and trustor of the deed of trust, and you don't do it, isn't the debt extinguished and there's nothing to guarantee?
No, the debt would not be extinguished. I don't know. I haven't thought this through. It's not the facts in this case. I think you would lose your opportunity, but the guarantee stands alone. The guarantee says if for any reason you can't collect from the debtor, from the maker, the guarantee stands.
Even your own failure to file a deficiency or to foreclose on the property?
Well, I think that might be a defense, but I think that it's still a legitimate argument to make that the guarantee stands alone. The reason we have the guarantee is so we can say no matter what happens, we might choose never to sue the borrowers. That's our right. We might just say, you know what, Mr. Walters has a lot of money. It's easy to get a judgment against him and collect. We'll go there. The borrowers and Mr. Walters can fight it out. This case is already decided. This court has already decided this case in McDonald. In that case, you had a lender suing a guarantor. You had an intervening bankruptcy that was an exemption from the one action rule. In that case, the court said, lender, go ahead, sue the guarantor. Just don't double recover. Nowhere in that case did this court say, all right, well, after there was a disposition of the property and a sale, that may implicate 40.4952 or 3, start over. Now file a deficiency action and now start again. There would be no need to. The guarantee action is the functional equivalent. You're giving them notice. You're giving them the opportunity to not double recover. You're going to have a hearing. Why do it again? Why start all over and create that trap for the unwary bank? We don't do that. This court should interpret the statutes the way the FDIC has identified. It allows this court to confirm its policy in McDonald, confirm its policies of statutory construction. The way he wants you to construe the statute renders meaningless the entire waiver. It makes it surplusage. By taking advantage of the waiver statutes, you extinguish your waiver. It doesn't give any credit to the policy behind the law or the reason why the waivers were implemented by the legislature in the first place. This court can confirm its policies, confirm its rules of statutory construction, and can confirm what the legislature did in 1989. If you do what Mr. Walters wants, you have to ignore your policies on statutory construction. You have to ignore McDonald. You have to ignore what the legislature did. You have to buy into demonstrable misstatements of the record. And you have to sanction, most crucially, sanction an injustice. He wants you to tell him he can walk away from a debt he doesn't owe because the bank somehow didn't satisfy some hyper-technical, small part of the statute. When the entirety of the statute has been satisfied, Judge Denton has identified it's been satisfied, Mr. Walters can get every bit of protection he wants through the hearing that the judge has already set, where we're going to present the evidence on the value of the loan and the value of the collateral. I posit that the policies have been satisfied. This writ petition should be denied. The case should be remanded back to have that hearing, and the protection set forth by this court in McDonald can be enjoyed by all parties. Thank you.
Your Honor, thank you. There's a real fundamental misunderstanding here by the FDIC as to what the statutes say. The argument that this is a one-action rule case and the one-action rule has been waived and that's it, no. That gets you nowhere in terms of this case, in terms of the statutes. You can waive the one-action rule. There can be a direct action on the guarantee, but, and that's 40.495 subsection 2. But subsection 3 then says, and this is the codification of the Shields case, it says, and I'll paraphrase it, if the bank then forecloses on the property, the guarantor can raise any of the defenses under 40.451 to 463. The principal defense there is you haven't sought a deficiency within 6 months. That's what the legislature said when it was amending the statute to conform to the Shields case. The bank said we don't want the property. All we want to do is pursue the guarantor. And the legislature said, you can see it in the minutes of both houses, okay, but what happens if you foreclose and take the property too? And finally, the banking industry said, oh, well, then we'll have to give the guarantor the protections of the deficiency statutes. Precisely what happened here. And Mr. Walters is now invoking the protections of those statutes.
Okay, Mr. Kennedy, let me ask, let's say we agreed with you on an argument that statutory interpretation. How, tell me why the April of 2009 counterclaim filed by the FDIC does not comply with 40.455 as tolling to 6 months.
It doesn't, and here's why. You look at the entirety of what they filed. They have a counterclaim against Mr. Walters. They have third-party claims against the borrowers, okay? The foreclosure has happened. The clock is running on that 6 months. What do? They file an action for deficiencies against the borrowers, citing the deficiency statute.
What did they allege against Mr. Walters in the April 09 amended counterclaim, I think is what it was? Mr. Silvestri saying that they're seeking the difference between the amount owed minus the fair market value of the property. Is that what they did?
No, they didn't.
Okay.
Okay? It's breach of guarantee. That's the claim. It's at volume 7. Page 1649, okay, breach of the guarantee, and they say, we'll give you an offset for our credit bid. Nothing in there about fair market value, nothing in there about the deficiency statute. They just say, we'll give you an offset for our credit bid. Credit bid could have been a million, could have been.
Right.
Nothing about fair market value. Here's the point. They knew what the statute said because they went against the borrowers under the statute. They elected not to pursue Mr. Walters under the statute. They said, we're going to do a guarantee. Suing the borrowers, offset for fair market value. Suing Mr. Walters, offset for the credit bid. If you look back at Shields, this court said, no, that you can't do that because you're trying to manipulate your payer sources. That's why the writ petition ought to be granted. The district court ought to be ordered to dismiss the action against Mr. Walters, not against everybody else that they're trying to collect from.
I want to thank counsel for the arguments presented this day. This matter will stand submitted.